I count it a real privilege to be able to serve the Lord.
Albert, listen to this tape, 11:30 of 98.
What he brought to humanity through the plan of salvation that he initiated, that he gave to the earth. We want to pick it up this evening now and move in a little different direction. We'd like to turn to Isaiah in the 9th chapter and begin reading at the 5th verse and on down a ways. Notice what he says here now, Isaiah 9 and 5. For every battle of the warrior is with confused noise and garments rolled in blood. Get a picture in your mind now of what he's talking about. He's talking about political power, governments, the armies that they call together to go out to defend their purposes. And this is what you'll expect to find in that kind of conflict. Every battle of the warrior is with confused noise and garments rolled in blood. But this shall be with burning and fuel of fire. This won't be a physical battle. It won't be a struggle man against man as individuals. It'll be with burning, that's purging, isn't it? That's the element that's used for purifying. It will be with fuel of fire. It'll go to that place where it needs purged. And that's where it'll function. That's where it'll operate. That's where it'll work its work. And that's where its results will be obvious. This battle will be with burning and fuel of fire. All right, then he turns from that and starts the description of what he has in mind. For unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. We recognize immediately the Christ, don't we? This is what he's talking about. Unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder. Notice this now. We pointed out last night, if you remember, that the true shepherd is the one that went through the gates into the sheepfold. He is the one that purchased the plan. He is the one that brought it to humanity. Then he is the legitimate one that should be the governing factor in it. Is he not? He should have the right and the privilege. That should be his responsibility to teach his sheep, if you will, how to so conduct themselves to be fit subjects of his. He has that right, doesn't he? We all acknowledge that. The government shall be upon his shoulders. That becomes his duty. That becomes his responsibility. More than that, it becomes his right. This belongs to him. Then he has not stepped out of bounds in assuming that position. It was delegated to him through the authority of the August Majesty on high. This is the prophecy that was given of him for how many years? 771 years, my Bible says, before Christ this was written. Then that long ahead of time, the Father on high was declaring that this one will have the right of governorship in this that he establishes. Then that settles it for me. I'm willing to accept that. The government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful. Why? Because he is outstanding above everybody else. There is no one else able to do what he's able to do. There's no one who has the right to do what he does. This is a place that he feels that is exclusive to him alone. He was the only begotten of the Father. There is none other that can stand up by his side and say, I'm equal with him. He is the only one. He fills that place then. His name shall be called Wonderful, because he was able to do what man needed done. We were in a fallen condition. He is the only candidate we know of who is able to lift us out of a life of sin. Then his name becomes Wonderful. Counselor, he is the candidate that's able to teach every one of us into that path of holiness. He is the one that can answer every problem you have, every question you encounter, every situation that you face, in every condition of life when we need instruction beyond our own capacity. Where do we turn? He is the counselor, isn't he? He's the one where we go. He is the one that's able to fill that place, and he's never failed one of us yet. Has he? Think of it. Wonderful Counselor, the mighty God, somebody superior to humanity. He identified himself with the Father. I and my Father are one, and I bring to you what my Father is. He told them in one place, they asked him, they said, shew us the Father, and it sufficeth us. I picture in my mind that he looked at Philip with astonishment, and he said, have I been so long time with you, and you have not seen the Father? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father, because I am what the Father is. Then he's not out of order to take that place, is he? Counselor, the mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, the Champion, the Prince, the one that stands supreme in it. He brought peace to the earth, didn't he? How did he do it? Remember how it started? For every battle of the warriors with confused noise and garments rolled in blood, but this shall be with burning and fuel of fire. How did he bring peace to your soul and mine? He burnt out the wickedness that was in there. He consumed it with the flame of his love. He washed it in the fountain of his blood. He took it away, and for every heart that this has taken place in, there is peace reigns in that heart. Because the guilt's gone. The condemnation is gone. We're at peace with God. What could we ask more than that? He is the Prince then. He is the one that is worthy. He is the one that brought it. He is the champion of it. He is our hero, if you want to put it like that. He's the one that we look to, because he is above all. Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. There is no force nor power big enough nor strong enough to defeat this. It goes forth, and it continues to go forth. We say, well, but the multitude of the world is going on in its sin. How can we say then that this is conquering? Because for every heart where Christ is able to take up his abode, his kingdom is enlarged that much. He'll get down to where there won't be hardly any. He asked us himself one time, will I come again? Will I find faith on the earth? It'll ebb away to that degree. But for every soul that will yield to it, it'll be just as potential at the last end as it was at the first end. It won't fail nor diminish. Its ability will be just as great as it's ever been. Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. Upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment. Notice this. Look up the meaning sometime of the word judgment. That's a whole lot more than some kind of judicial condemnation. A judgment can be a formal utterance of an authoritative opinion. When I assess a situation and I give you what my feeling is about it, I've given you my judgment. This is the way I judge this matter. This one, he said, his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment. He is the one that's able to tell you and I how to be children of God, how to be Christians. He did that. He looks at our situation in the position that we're in right now and is able to tell us the path to take under these conditions. This is his judgment in the matter. He leaves it up to us always to make our own choice. We're always given option. This is the way Christ would have you go. Well, but I don't want to go that way. Then you are at liberty to select the path that you prefer to follow. But if you're willing to follow his judgment, he will teach you the path of righteousness. He makes that his duty. He takes that as his responsibility, and he is faithful to every soul. All right, he said he'd establish it then with judgment, that's his judgment, and with justice. He won't make any mistake about his assessment. He knows exactly the path of righteousness for every man to follow. He knows exactly the steps every individual will have to take to follow in the paths of righteousness. He knows the attitude and the sentiment of every heart. He knows what's going on in man in the action that he takes, and he won't make no mistake about that assessment. When we try to follow him with dishonesty in our hearts, telling ourselves one thing, knowing all the time that the truth is something else, he'll pinpoint that exactly. We don't fool the Lord. This is what he's talking about. This is serious business, isn't it? It wasn't this beautiful language put in here to thrill somebody and to give us something to discuss and talk about. These are factual statements that have to do with our relationship with God, with Almighty God, with the Eternal God. He'll establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. From the time that Christ began preaching in Galilee till now, this is what's been going forth. His judgments in justice, teaching men how to be saved. It's still here today, isn't it? How can I say that positively? Because it's true in me. I have followed his ways, and he brought me to salvation, took away my sins, removed my guilt. It's still working. It thrills my soul. He said it won't ever cease with justice from henceforth, even forever. Remember, he said, the government shall be upon his shoulders. His name shall be called Wonderful. Now listen to this. Here is the seal. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. This is not left to human capability. This is not left to the function of a committee. This is not left to a group of people. These are facts that God will see to it goes into execution, as Christ has to do with every soul that's ever come to the age of accountability in this world. That's pretty big thinking, isn't it? But you ponder it. It was true then. It's just as true today. It's just as valid today as it was when it was written. It's just as valid as it was when Christ accepted it and put it into function. It was here. It is here. It's working. It belongs to you and I, to every child of God. I'd like for us to move over into the New Testament now. In the fourth chapter of St. Luke's Gospel, we'd like to start reading at the 16th verse. St. Luke chapter 4, verse 16. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up for to read. And there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor." Here are the gatekeepers, isn't it? Looking on. The Word and the Spirit. Giving their sanction. He, through the authority of the Father, the anointing given to him from the August Majesty on high, the prophecy that was given of him from ages on back, now here he is sitting in their midst and proclaiming, here is what has been prophesied. It's in fulfillment now. It's going into function. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted. What was it that broke the hearts of men? It was sin, wasn't it? Wickedness, the iniquity. Men that did wrong when they didn't want to do wrong. When they would have done better if they could, but they didn't have any power to do better. I believe David loved the Lord with all of his heart, don't you? But when he faced a temptation strong enough, his flesh overcame him. He wasn't able to defeat it. This now is talking about something else. I am come to send me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, to those whom sin had taken captive at its will. Here is this force and power that will break these chains and turn that candidate loose. Boy, it makes our hearts leap for joy, doesn't it? Preach deliverance to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind. Whereas before, all I could think of was my own interest and my own desires and my own pleasures. But now I could see the beauty of holiness, the purity of righteousness, the virtue of a sinless life, and the desire in me that yearned after that no longer had to be denied. I could enter into it and be a partaker of it. He could become a part of me. I could become a part of him. We could be joined together in oneness. I could see truth as he saw truth. And as he saw it, it could begin to function in me, lived out in me. Deliverance to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised. Oh, think of it. To preach the acceptable year of the Lord. Oh, we read last night, pointed out, that when man fell in the garden, the August Majesty on high put the sentinels there to keep the gate. But now the time has come, he said, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. The time has come for the tree of life to be exposed to humanity again. The gates be opened. Those who had come in that prescribed path, follow the true shepherd, could go through the steps that were necessary and enter into the gate and receive of the tree of life. And he closed the book, and he gave it again to the minister and sat down, and the eyes of all them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began to say unto them, this day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears. Think of that. From that day forth, these things that he proclaimed here have been true. They're just as true for you and me today as they were then. They're just as potential. They're just as valid. They're just as effective. They're just as capable. They can do what Christ said they would do. I find it true in my life, don't you? It thrills my soul to think about it. Let's move over here in the 6th chapter of St. John, and let's read some more. I want the 34th verse, 6th chapter, St. John's Gospel. Then said they unto him, Lord, evermore, give us this bread. And Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. I have nothing more to give to you than what I am. I simply give of myself to you. I am inviting you to partake of me, to devour me into yourself, to let you steep out through you what I am. That's what our food does, isn't it? We take it in at our mouth. It goes into our stomachs. It digests and goes through our body and disposes of its essence out to us. And thus we're able to be the beings that we are. This to me is what he's talking of here. I am the bread of life. I have given you the words that if you will assimilate them and let them move through you, it will work in you what I am. Because what I have said to you are the very things that make me what I am. I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger. The man that really comes to Christ with all of his heart, with the sincerity of his soul, that man will never go away disappointed. He'll find what his soul's looking for. I can promise you that. The Word of God promises that. He'll never hunger. And he that believeth on me shall never thirst. He's not talking about belief as it has to do with whether or not I'm willing to acknowledge a thing so. I can look at this bench and say, I believe this bench is here. The reason I believe that is because the evidence is here to convince me. There is no Christ that you can look at with these eyes. The belief that we're going to have to do is in a thing that we cannot see. I cannot reach out and put my hand on his shoulder. Can you? I cannot reach out with my arms and embrace him. Yet I'm thoroughly convinced that he is there. The belief that he's talking about goes beyond a physical evidence, or for that matter, a demonstrated supernatural evidence. He's looking for a belief strong enough that I am willing to accept whatever he is into me and let him live and work in me superior to my own thinking, my own human thinking. To be willing to put mine out that he might live in me. That's the kind of belief he's talking about. That's the kind of belief that it's hard for human to accept. We depend on our own mentality for our own guidance, for our own counsel, for our own instruction, for the path that we follow. We call it sometimes common sense, clear thinking, our reasoning, all of this kind of thing. But listen, every man that's lived for the Lord very long has come to the place to realize that my own thinking is not sufficient. That when I think for myself, I think in wrong channels, and I move in the wrong direction. I'll give place to my own pleasures at the expense of what was really right and virtuous. I won't take the right path. What he's talking about is a belief strong enough in him to be willing to put him superior in my life, in every issue of life, in every confrontation that I come to. Remember what he said in the prophecy? This battle shall be with burning and a fuel of fire. Burning out my own selfish ways, my own human ways, and giving place to him and his true righteousness. Oh, he said, he that believeth on me shall never thirst. If I'll walk with him that intimately, if I'll yield myself to him that fully, if I'll give myself to him thoroughly and entirely, then here's the promise. I am the bread of life to that one. He that cometh to me shall never hunger. And he that believeth on me to that extent will never thirst. We'll find the desires of our heart. We'll find that our soul yearns after. But I said unto you, that ye also have seen me and believe not. You have walked with me right here in these paths that I have followed. You have seen, observed the things that I've done. You have listened to the counsel that I've given, and you're still not willing to yield yourself to that extent. This is a belief that he was talking about, isn't it? All that the Father giveth me shall come to me. Who is it that the Father gave to the Son? Did he pick out a select few and say, you of this family and you of this tribe and you of this group and you of this city will be accepted and all the rest will be excluded? He never gave no such thing as that. The proclamation he made was that for everyone that would hunger and thirst after righteousness, That's the one that would be filled. That's the one that would find what his soul was looking for. That's just as true today as it was then, isn't it? Way back in the prophets, somebody read it here in the chapel the other night. I may not get it just verbatim, but you'll know what I'm talking about. Perhaps someone read it, "In the day you seek me with a whole heart, that's the day I'll be found in you." These are the ones that the Father gave to the Son. Those who with all their hearts wanted to know and understand the ways of righteousness that they might walk in them, they came to Christ. And as they come, they find the yearning of their soul. And so they're blessed. "All that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will in no wise cast out." My soul thrills again. When I came, he didn't cast me out either. I felt like the least of the least. I felt like if there's anybody more worthy than me, it'd be anybody else that came. But when I came, he reached to me too. He gave me the desire of my soul, as he does to every hungry soul. There's not a one goes away unfed. He has an abundance for all. He said, "For I came down from heaven, not to do mine own will, but the will of him that sent me." He came down here not in some kind of ambitious campaign of his own to build fame or to build power or to build recognition. He came down here humbling himself to the will of his Father, willing to do what God expected of him to do. Oh, think of it. We expressed a thought here a few weeks ago in a Bible study. I don't know if you picked it up or not, but if you didn't, pick it up and think about it. Creation is the expression of the power of God. Causation, that makes creation function, that influence that causes created universe to operate, that's the expression of the will of God. He not only designed it and built it, but he had the power to put it into function. You see? That's the expression of his will. Then in the Son, the only begotten Son, he sent to us the expression of his will in him. And the Son is testifying to that. "I am performing in your presence what the will of the Father is for me and for you." This is God's will for humanity, that I come and be just what I am right here, that you might understand how to fill his will too. He made every one of us. That's creation. But he wants us to function in accord with his will. You see what I'm getting at? I want his will done in me, don't you? When my own self-life rises up, when I contest what he requires of me, when I began to talk back to him and tell him what my preference is in opposition to what his will is, I am contending with the very one that I'm trying to serve, and I defeat my own purpose. Let's get a hold of this. "But the will of him that sent me," this is what our Christ came to do. He proclaimed to us one time, he said, "I do always those things that please my Father." That's the pattern he laid down for us. This is the shepherd of the sheep. This is the one who came to get us into the sheepfold. This is part of the path that he prescribed for men to follow. "And this is the Father's will, which has sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing." My soul thrills again. Do you see anything here to be thrilled about? If I'll yield my life to him, if I'll give my heart totally to him, there is nothing can separate me from that. He should lose nothing. Political powers can't do it. Men have gone to martyrdom by the multiplied thousands rather than give up this that they found in their heart. That's true. But if I treasure this more than I treasure my own physical existence, I'll lay down my life before I'll turn this loose. Won't I? That's what it means to do His will. Oh, think of it. And this is the Father's will, which has sent me, that of all which He hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. I have confidence in Him that He's able to do just exactly what He said here. Don't you? I know it's true. And this is the will of Him that sent me, that every one which seeth the Son and believeth on Him may have everlasting life. What did Christ come to restore to humanity? The very thing that was lost in the fall. Remember? And He started out over in John, "He that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep." That's just exactly what He is. "This is a will of Him that sent me, that every one which seeth the Son and believeth on Him, believe to the point that we're willing to receive Him into ourselves, to prefer Him there above ourselves, to be willing to sacrifice ourselves that He might live in us, to believe on Him, may have everlasting life." That's access back to the tree of life, isn't it? "And I will raise Him up at the last day." Oh, think about this. Look over here in the 59th verse now, the same chapter, 6th chapter of St. John. We'll go to the 59th verse. He said, "These things said He in the synagogue, as He taught in Capernaum. Many therefore of His disciples, when they had heard this, said, This is an hard saying. Who can hear it? You see the flesh now rebelling, is that the word? Doubting? Questioning? This is a hard thing. He's asking us to do something beyond human capability. Does He do that? Yes, He does that. He'll ask you and I to do things that without His grace we'll never be able to do. But He is faithful to supply the grace. What did He say back in the beginning? Grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. The first element He put there was grace. He followed it by the truth. When we'd come to a realization that sin was going to have to be burned out of our lives, no man had ever been able to burn sin out of his own life, then it's no wonder that He sent grace first to give us that assurance that as the requirement comes, so the power is here sufficient for me to take hold of the promise and sin can be eliminated from my life. That's what salvation is, isn't it? "And when they heard this, said, This is an hard saying. Who can hear it?" When Jesus knew in Himself that His disciples murmured at it, He said unto them, "Doth this offend you? When you look at me, hear the words that I say, realize in your heart the magnitude of the meaning of the words as they convey to your understanding, and you draw back. What would it take to convince you? Doth this offend you?" Listen to what He said. "What, and if ye shall see the Son of Man ascend up where He was before?" When these things that you're stumbling over now, when these thoughts and ideas and this understanding that has been brought to your consciousness through the word that I have taught unto you, and you look at it from your human standpoint and stagger at it and begin to doubt, would it make any difference to you if you beheld me as I ascended back to the presence of God where I was before this started? If you could see that physically, if you could see that with your natural eyes, would that not supply you evidence to be able to believe stronger? That's what He was saying, isn't it? Can we believe without that? We must believe without that. We won't get that kind of demonstration. We'll have to accept His word for it, that it is true, that He ascended back to the bosom of the Father, that He is there now interceding for you and I, that He is watching with attentiveness over every one of us all the time, everywhere. Our present help in every time of need, that's the Christ. Oh, He wants us to believe to that dimension, doesn't He? What an if ye shall see the Son of Man ascend up where He was before. It is the Spirit that quickeneth. This battle is not physical. You won't meet the enemy hand to hand. You won't get into a fist and skull fight with him. This struggle, what did he say, is with burning and with fuel of fire. It's as his word began to reveal in us the elements of iniquity, those attitudes, those sentiments, those dispositions that cause us to go astray, that fill us with selfishness and with greed and with jealousy and envy and hatred and all of this. We'll recognize them by the teaching of His word and by the application of His grace. They're burned out. And so we're delivered from their power and influence. That's the way this battle is. And that's where the struggle that we encounter is carried forth. It is the Spirit that quickeneth. The flesh profiteth nothing. Listen to this. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. Here is a truth. Here is a proclamation that ought to stand out in bold-faced type for every one of us. The words that he speaks, they carry the force, the power, the strength of spirit and life. No other individual that you and I know anything about has the right or the power to inject that kind of influence into the words that we give. Only he has that ability. Only he was commissioned to do that. He was sent to this earth to teach us the ways of righteousness, to lay out for us the path from sin to salvation. He was able to give us the words that would make us able. Then the words that he speaks to us become spirit and life. But no other man has a right to put that influence into the words that he speaks. Let's mark this well and take it with us, because we're going to need it. Think of this now. I may take the word of Christ. I may take the scripture as it's written. I may go with it as far as it goes and then decide it stopped too short and add on a little of mine. But I have not the power to inject spirit and life into that word that I add on. Whatever it is that I contribute over and above that that he gave, then it falls back to human capability and it is not able to do what his does. You see what I'm talking about? He owned what belonged to him. The words that he speaks to us, they are spirit and they are life. But any other doesn't have that capability. Then we'll be foolish to follow anything else but his. Would we not? Think about it. But there are some of you that believe not. In the face of all of this, there are still some of you who doubt. Do you remember Thomas? When he was resurrected, when he had gone to the cross, when he walked here for 3.5 years, went through the trial, Thomas was there and saw the whole thing. He was resurrected and came out of the grave, and Thomas saw it all, and he still doubted. What would it take to bring you to the place? He instructed him again, and he said, don't keep on doubting, but believe. Believe enough to be willing to receive me into yourself. That's what he's calling for in you and me. To love him enough to open our hearts and lives and let him come in and take up jurisdiction in here. until his will is preferred above mine, and I'll put mine down that I might have his, because I know the virtue of what he has. But there are some of you that believe not, for Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not, and who should betray him. I read this scripture for years, and the thought that always was paramount in my mind when I read it was that Jesus looked at the 12 and he knew exactly which one of them it was that was going to betray. Let me tell you something. He's looking at every one of us and he knows exactly which one of us is not believing to the place that we accept him fully. And he knows when that's there that we'll betray him somewhere in life's journey. Pretty serious thinking, isn't it? We need to serve the Lord just like he said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy soul, all thy mind, and all thy strength. Remember? Jesus knows when that fullness is not there. And he knows that if that remains there, in time to come, we'll betray him. The enemy will see to it that the events of life present us with a situation that if there's a flaw in it, it'll bring it to the surface and it'll manifest. We see it happen, don't we? Who should betray him? And he said, therefore said I unto you that no man can come unto me except it were given unto him of my Father. Do you see the efficiency of the gatekeepers still keeping the way of the tree of life? When we come with dishonesty, when we come with a half heart, when we come hoping and yet we're doubting, unless we get rid of this, we're not going to make it past the gatekeepers. Had you ever thought of that? This is what it means to serve the Lord with all of our heart, isn't it? All right. I want to move away from this now. I want you to take these thoughts, store them in your mind, retain them there, because they're going to mean something to us as we go along. Further on in the study, they're going to become pretty prominent. Don't forget what we said up till now. We're going to move away from that for a little bit. And we want to look at a contrast to it. Turn with me to 115 of Psalms. We'll begin reading at the first verse, Psalm 115. Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name give glory, for thy mercy and for thy truth's sake. Wherefore should the heathen say, where is now their God? But our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. It pleased the Father. Remember that? That in Christ should all fullness dwell. It pleased the Father that there should be a plan of salvation, that there should be a means of deliverance. His zeal saw to it that it came into being. He presented it to humanity. It's here today. But our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. Notice this now. He's talking about the creations that men provide for themselves, that humanity strives to erect for its own purposes and intents. Here is the characteristics, he said, that they'll have. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. Remember the thought that we expressed a minute ago? He said, the words that I speak unto you, they have spirit and they have life, but that man creates doesn't have those qualities. See the contrast? They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. They can produce in appearance all the physical qualities but they have not the ability to animate any of them. They're lifeless. They can't put any kind of animation into it. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Neither speak they through their throat. They that make them are like unto them. A man cannot produce something superior to what he is. If I am not a master carpenter, I cannot build fine furniture. If I am not an accomplished mechanic, I cannot overhaul an automobile. If I set out then to try to tell somebody else how to do it, you'd say, you're completely out of place. You know what you're talking about. When men set out to build a plan of salvation or to establish a means back into God's favor, they're out of place because they don't know what they're talking about. They that make them are like unto them. So is everyone that trusteth in them. If we're willing to accept that kind of presentation, put it in our lives as though it were that of Word and Spirit to which life has been given, then we're not fooling anybody but ourselves, are we? Get a hold of this. So is everyone that trusteth in them. O Israel, trust thou in the Lord. He is their help and their shield. Of Israel, he will bless the house of Aaron. He will bless them that fear the Lord, both small and great. The Lord shall increase you more and more, you and your children. Ye are blessed of the Lord, which made heaven and earth. Why are we blessed? Because we believed what he taught us. Because we received of its essence. Because we let it work in us. And thus we became favored in his eyes. And he poured out upon us of his approval. That's what it amounts to, isn't it? All right. Put these thoughts in your mind because I want to present you something else. Do you remember way back in the beginning? He talked to Abraham. And he told him, he said, I have chosen you not because you're the greatest, but because you're the least. But I will make a people out of you, a nation, through your family. Keep this in mind now. While all of this was going on way back yonder, there were other influences working in societies. Here are two or three thoughts that I want you to think about when we go to this. First of all, let's recognize there is something in every man that prompts him to worship. Humanity was made to worship. And every individual has an intuition toward something outside of himself. He may distort it into all kinds of deformed application, but every man looks to something. They call it luck, maybe, whatever, but he's looking at something outside of his own strength or his own ability. You see what I'm talking about? That was born in there. We were designed to worship God. Something is going to fill that place. The man who does not serve God will invent something of his own making to fill the place. That's an idol. When I invent something to fill the place that God designed to fill, that becomes an idol to me. It does to you. It does to any man that follows it. That becomes his idol. We read of savages. Most of us today are not that primitive to go back into where we grab a fetish of some kind and we say, this is what we worship, and we set this up and we get down and pray to it and all of that. Not many people do that. What they do is in the intellect, in their mind. They formulate a pattern. They formulate a system. They formulate a manner of conduct. And they put that supreme in them, and they follow this. People will tell you, well, I'm not such a bad fellow. And they begin to list to you their virtues. That's human thinking. That is their idol. That's where they fall down. I'll go as far as this idol requires me to go, and I feel no obligation to go any further. And they don't. That's an idol. Idol worship is heathen worship. Don't you forget it. That's just as heathen as the savage that gets his little fetish, the rabbit's foot, or whatever it is that he wants to fall down to. But one is just as wrong in God's eyes as the other. All right, here's another thought to put along with this. Such invention is often made on a collective basis. It's not so much the formulation of idea that I concocted, but I'm willing to subscribe to what I saw so-and-so, what he presented. I accept his formula. It's still an idol. Think about this now. You think about the true shepherd that went through the gate and got into the sheepfold that could bring us the plan, the truth, the real. I want to read to you about ancient religions. While the Old Testament was in the building, while the old tabernacle was in the wilderness, while God was dealing with this people that he said was the least of all nations, he was able to find in them one man that would believe. You remember what we said about belief? He believed enough to be willing to follow God against his own better judgment. When God called him out of his homeland into a foreign land, he submitted and yielded and obeyed the Lord. He went from where he was over to the Canaan land, to the promised land. God built out of him a nation because he could teach his posterity how to believe to that degree. And as they believed, God could work with them and teach them into true righteousness. While this was going on, there was multitudes of people in the earth, and they were doing something else. I want to read you about that a little bit. Buddhism. 552 years before Christ, Gautama, an Indian prince, was born. In afterlife, he assumed the name Buddha, the Enlightened, and became the founder of the Oriental religion known as Buddhism. Buddhism was an outgrowth of Hinduism, and its early development must be understood in the light of this fact. Gautama became dissatisfied with the gross sensuality of the Hinduism surrounding him, and at last withdrew himself from the world, first to asceticism, and when he became convinced that that offered no hope, to mystical contemplation, to endeavor to find a way of escape from the pain and sorrows of life. During this stage of his life, he discovered what seemed to him the way. You think about the true shepherd now. This man was looking for a way out. The doctrine which he set out to propagate was as follows. One, suffering and sorrow. Birth, growth, decay, death, all cause sorrow. All states of mind which coexist with consciousness of individuality are states of suffering. Two, the cause of suffering. The action of the outer world upon us excites delight or desire, and these alike are the cause of sorrow. This is this man's thinking now. Number three, the cessation of sorrow. The annihilation of all thirst and lust of life is deliverance from sorrow. Four, the way of deliverance is the noble eightfold path, and so he lists the eight. Number one, right belief. Number two, right feelings. Number three, right speech. Number four, right actions. Number five, right means of livelihood. Number six, right endeavor. Number seven, right memory. Number eight, right meditation. All these injunctions sound like a Christian rule of life, but when we begin to question their meaning, we are disappointed to learn that most of these right things are in reality wrong things. Right belief turns out to be belief in the doctrines Buddha taught. Right feelings turn out to be the absence of all feeling toward everyone and everything. You compare these now to the requirements of Christianity. Right speech turns out to be not to lie so that you will be found out. Right actions turn out to be negative rules of restraint of one's passions, very good in themselves, but totally inadequate for the guidance of men's lives. Right means of livelihood turns out to be getting one's living by means of begging, making a merit of what should be man's shame. Right endeavor means mental labor only, while right thought means thought about Buddha's doctrines, and right meditation means putting one's mind in a trance in order to communicate with Buddha or the annihilation of thought. We look for a way of salvation and find only a pessimistic laziness. In this brief sketch of Buddhism, we see several outstanding things that marked its spread. The periods of intensest missionary activity were the periods when it was backed by political power and prestige. This was one of the chief causes of its spread. The second main cause of its spread was the fact that it always adapted itself to the religion of the country where it went. The main course of its appeal to its converts was that it offered them a way by which they could earn salvation. By going through certain rites and ceremonies, a thing which naturally appeals to the religious instincts of man, all men naturally feel that they should earn their own salvation, and such a way of salvation naturally appeals to them. Then another cause of its spread was the fact that it made it possible to satisfy man's natural inclinations toward laziness by making laziness a virtue. All these causes are amply able to account for the growth and spread of the religion. That's Buddhism. Let's look at Hinduism. The oldest living religion in the world is Hinduism. Probably more than any other one thing, it owes its vitality to its caste system, which holds the inhabitants of India in iron bands stronger than steel ever made. The whole people is divided into a system of castes which are more rigidly observed than are the laws of morality. No member of a lower caste can associate with a member of a higher caste. It is this system of caste which gives a unifying principle to a religion which is said to possess 330 million gods. As a matter of fact, Hinduism is not a religion, but a social system that embraces all manner of religion. The only way the religion is spread is by inheritance, or by a Brahmin going into a new locality and dividing the people into castes, at the same time declaring the local deity to be a Hindu god. The people in the caste have no choice in the matter, since all the castes which are higher than theirs unite to force them into their proper place. It makes no difference what the belief of the individual may be, whether he be atheist, monotheist, or polytheist. As long as he keeps the caste rules, he can do as he pleases and believe what he pleases. Of course, Hinduism requires no ethical or moral laws to be kept and makes no pretense at any requirement of regeneration for a person to be a member of any caste. The immorality and sensuality of the religion itself is so marked that nothing in the way of morality can be expected from the devotees of the religion. In addition to this caste system, Hinduism owes its existence to the adaptability with which it absorbs within itself any competing or opposing religion. New religions simply become new castes, or the new ideas are incorporated into the already existing castes. As we have already pointed out, Hinduism is in reality a social system and not a religion, so that it can in no way be compared with Christianity. You think about this now when you think of Brother Varghese. This is what he faces all the time. Think of this. What is the population of India? Something over 900 million people. Is that right? Or is it 9 million? 900 million people. I read somewhere not long ago that, if I remember correctly, Brother Varghese says they have about 200 in their congregation over there. You see the power this kind of thing has. Taoism. The founder of Taoism, Lao Tzu, was born about 604 years before Christ in Hunan Province, China. The religion which he founded was so called after the book which he wrote a short time before he died. In this book, he set forth an ethical code of many good thoughts, but advocated man's withdrawing from the world and contemplating To as a means of attaining peace and comfort. The religion which sprang up after his death soon incorporated the animism of the land in itself and became a religion of necromancy, geomancy, and demon worship. It spread through fear and peopled the earth and rivers with demons and dragons, whom the people must propitiate with sacrifices and gifts if they would live in peace and prosperity. Do you remember, some of you older ones will remember when it came around to the 4th of July and we used to go around to buy the firecrackers, and they were nearly all made in China, and they all had these pictures of dragons and stuff on there. You remember? This was on there because the people, the business people over there, they had those emblems on their product because to them that was an assurance that this god, this idol that they worshipped, would be a blessing to them and their product would sell. To us, I thought it was just some kind of a fantastic picture that they put on there to attract my attention. But it was there because they worshipped this. And they was looking to this to prosper their handiwork. You see a great many things that come out of the Chinese market over here, and it has these grotesque emblems on it, these pictures on it. That's what that is. It's there for that purpose. They worship these idols. It spread through fear and peopled the earth and rivers with demons and dragons, whom the people must propitiate with sacrifices and gifts if they would live in peace and prosperity. The priests were and are the only ones interested in perpetuating the religion, and the only interest they had was that of gain. The principal reason the religion spread and gained a hold was because it played on the superstitions of the people and made them fear all the surrounding evil spirits and think that unless these gifts were propitiated, some dire evil would come upon them. How'd you like to serve a god like that? The only way they could be prohibited was by calling a Taoist priest and hiring him to offer sacrifice or diagnose the cause of some sickness or disturbance so that the spirit could cease troubling the family or town. The priests continually played on the fears of the people and thus forced them to support their temples and the priests themselves. Of course, Taoism is so mixed with the other religions of China that it is impossible to distinguish between the true followers of the religion and those who are really Buddhists or Confucianists and who only offer sacrifice to the demons out of fear, it is easy to see that what has been said above, that It is easy to see from what has been said above that there is nothing remarkable about either the growth or the continuance of this religion. It was a religion founded on fear, spread through fear, and existing through fear. It has no appeal to morality or regeneration. In Confucianism, we have the supreme example of the power of state education and family discipline. Confucianism conquered a mighty nation solely through the education and family discipline, all of which goes to show the truth of the old adage that if you repeat a thing often enough and do it sincerely, you can make almost everyone believe you. To Confucius, the golden age of wisdom and righteousness was in the past, and he believed that by spreading broadcast all the accumulated knowledge and wisdom of the ancients, society could be reformed and be made perfect. It was this ideal that he set out to realize, to regenerate society by spreading the knowledge of right principles. He claimed no supernatural knowledge or power and taught no religion as such. He was an ethical philosopher and sage who believed that the world could be regenerated through knowledge. Needless to say, Confucius was doomed to disappointment, for it takes more than knowledge to regenerate society. It is useless to try to change the mind while the heart is filled with evil. Neither Confucius nor his followers claimed that their ethical system was a religion or that it had any supernatural origin. In actual fact, however, Confucianism is a religion, for around the system of ethics has sprung up the worship of heaven, the powers of nature, Confucius himself, and the imperial ancestors, in addition to the worship of the ancestors of each individual family. Of course, since the foundation of the Republic, the state worship has largely ceased, but though ancestor worship is as firmly fixed as ever, and since all this is admittedly of human origin and growth, the religion holds no problems for us in the search for supernaturalism in religion. It is well to point out several other facts about Confucianism which show why it appeals to the people. It is a ceremonial religion and fosters polygamy and the system of concubinage. If a person worships his ancestors faithfully, he can live as he pleases and be in good standing with his fellows. While Confucian classics teach many virtues, the maxims have little hold on the hearts and lives of the followers, and no real regeneration is either demanded or expected. These facts, coupled with the educational system and ancestor worship, are amply able to account for the origin and spread of the religion. Shintoism is in no sense a world religion. It was deliberately fostered and nurtured by the state to lead the people to reverence and worship the emperor as a god. The mythology of this religion has produced a loyalty to country and emperor which the Westerner can hardly understand or appreciate. According to these Shinto myths, the first Japanese emperor was descended from the goddess of the sun, and the islands and the Japanese people have sprung from gods. The islands are filled with thousands of the Shinto shrines, their chief characteristic being the absence of idols. It is the spirit dwelling in the place that is worshipped. While the religion claims to be supernatural, the grotesque myths, unsupported by evidence, render its claims negligible. It is in no sense a missionary religion, and its spread was due solely to governmental protection and influence. It tickled the pride of the Japanese to be told that they were all the offspring of gods and thus far superior to the rest of the world, but the claims of the religion are absolutely unsupported by evidence or supernatural proofs. These brief accounts of these I've read in your hearing because I want you to see the difference. I want you to recognize what happens when men begin to formulate systems of worship. Notice some of the characteristics of this. None of these that I read to you, not any of them, make any attempt to restore man to what he was before he fell into sin. Do you remember what the Savior said? He that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, the same is a thief and a robber. You remember? He didn't come to save, he came to steal and to rob and to kill. None of these offer any moral improvement for the souls of men. The hungry soul won't find any answer there. Why? Because its propagator never got through the gates. It never got in touch with the ways of the tree of life. It couldn't present anything superior to humanity, to what humanity already is, because it had nothing else to offer. It sprang from humanity, and it not able to elevate itself above itself. And so it presented this system. None of these offers any supernatural intervention. Did you notice that? Not any of them pointed to any higher power. It just appealed to us to improve ourselves, if you will. All of these are humanly devised and humanly applied, and they possess no ability to elevate the soul beyond human level. That's tragic, isn't it? That's tragic. To us, this is a far removed thing, and we don't normally think about things like this. These and similar movements through the ages have influenced humanity by the multiplied billions. Listen to me. Multiplied billions. India, 900 million people today. Think of what it's been clear back through the centuries. This thing started 600-700 years before Christ, and it's influenced this whole multitude of people all this time. Do you think these things are not powerful? These Oriental religions, where the most concentrated population of the world has always been, were so firmly established over there that when the gospel of heaven came to this world, it wasn't hardly able to penetrate it at all. It found no large footing there at all. The masses of the people were so completely satisfied with this until they rejected everything else. Now we can understand a little better what Jesus meant when he said, "Straight is the gate and narrow is the way, and few there be that find it." What is it? Where did these come from? This is human thinking put into function, and multitudes have given themselves to that. It had no leader that went through the gate, that got through to the Father on high, that got into contact and touch with the fountain of life. It has no access to anything beyond this life. What a tragedy, what a tragedy. Men in multitude yielding themselves to this kind of thing, this is heathenism. This is the worship of idols. I'll follow this system in preference to this Christ that you talked to me about, that's willing to come with burning and fuel of fire and clean up the inner man. I'd rather follow this because it's easier, because I prefer it. You see the difference? You see now what Christ meant when he said, "He that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold is a thief and a robber." He didn't come for anything else but to steal and to rob and to kill. He did all of that. And when its subjects get in trouble, it just walks away and leaves them in trouble. But he came, the true shepherd. "I am the shepherd of the sheep." I had hoped that our time would run longer. I had scripture here that I wanted to use. I may use it yet tomorrow. To point out the difference between the emptiness of these human systems and the fullness of the gospel of Jesus Christ that the Father sent down to you and I. Oh, ponder these things and think about them. We're going to study some more as we go along. I want to live for him and do his will. He means everything to me. I'd like you to pray for me.